The Jazz Scene Podcast gives an in-depth look at the lives and stories of the musicians performing in Columbus and beyond. Today's episode is hosted by Alex Burgoyne, Director of Production for the Jazz Arts Group of Columbus.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Scene Podcast. My name is Alex Burgoyne and I'm here today with Abby Chebolu.
Hi, hey, Alex.
How's it going?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. Full disclosure, Abby and I have known each other for a long time, going on, coming up to 20 years-ish, right?
Since 2006.
Yeah.
So, oh, yeah. About
wow.
18.
We're getting old. Yeah. Abby and I were at Capitol together. But let's back up from there a little bit. Abby, you grew up in Central Ohio, right?
I did. Yeah, I'm from right here in Columbus. I wasn't born here, but I've been here since I was five. I started playing music at a pretty young age. I was 7 years old when I started playing classical guitar.
That's very abnormal, right?
It's atypical, I guess. Certainly, I remember bringing my guitar into school for like show and tell. Uh-huh. And it was, you know, most people brought, I don't know what, but it was different for sure. Yeah, and then I think it was like maybe sixth grade, I switched to electric. And then at some point, like early in high school, it became clear that music was something that was very important to me, that I was going to kind of take seriously and make kind of the focus in my life. And then a friend of mine actually told me about the Fort Hays Career Center, mm-hmm. Which was a great experience for me. I distinctly remember I had been playing with some musicians I had met before. Like I had met this bass player in school, and I knew this drummer because he was like my mom's friend's kid, and so we would get together and do some playing. But I remember my friend just telling me, "Hey, you should check out this career center. Like, they put you in bands and they get you gigs." And I was like, "What?
Amazing!"
Like, I thought, okay, I didn't know that was like a real thing that I could do. I just knew I loved music and playing it, and I was
honestly,
like, okay.
There's not a better advertisement to a 14-year-old probably than bands and gigs, right?
Yeah, I mean that's all it took. I was like, okay, let me learn more about this, and I did the audition for Jeff McCargish at Fort Hays. I actually started there just the year after Jim and Neri was no longer there, so I only got to study with Jeff, but it was great. I mean, that experience opened a lot of doors for me because I really didn't know that music was something that you could take seriously and kind of make a career out of.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't know that you could study music in college. I was dreading the whole "where are you going to go to college" conversation growing up because there weren't really many other subjects that I could see myself pursuing. And so, you know, through that experience at Fort Hays, I realized that this was something viable that I could do. And that's what led to me going to Capitol and studying with, you know, Stan Smith and Mark Pflugi. And I also studied some composition with Dina Lenzner. And, that put me on the path where, you know, I am here today.
When did the jazz bug, when did the improvisation bug kind of bite? Were you at Capitol before you started doing that stuff, or was it before?
So I started improvising, I would say it was when I was at Fort Hays. The first group that I was put in, we were playing, I think we were mostly listening to, rock or, whatever was on the radio and, under the rock umbrella at the time. But I really just didn't know what I was doing, and this sounds really
familiar.
Somehow that led to let's play something, and somehow we kind of started improvising at some point. But it was absent of context or genre because mm-hmm. we were just young and didn't know what we were doing.
Sure,
but you know, some of those it was free improvisations that evolved into I guess rock and roll songs. The jazz bug hit me. I was taking guitar lessons in high school, and this is going to sound really arrogant. Fair warning, but I had gotten a point, in taking guitar lessons where, you know, everything else that I was doing just got kind of boring.
Sure.
I got to the point where, you know, if I heard a song on the radio, it's like, oh, I hear it, and it's like, oh, I can already tell, okay, this is how you play it. And there was, like, there was no more challenge. And I think, like, a lot of places in this interview, you'll see a lot of things come down to just, like, me being ignorant at the time. And, like,
so honestly, an amazing gift for a young musician, usually. Ignorance, yeah.
Yeah. If I didn't have this teacher pushing me, I may not have known that I could have continued in a certain way, but I could tell that there was a certain point where my teacher was like, okay, well, like, she's doing all this stuff, and it's, you know, she's not being challenged, so what's next? And he was a jazz guy, so he was just like, hey, here's some music that you're not familiar with. I think you should try it. And I was just, you know, I said, okay. I thought it was interesting because it was the first challenge I had on my instrument in, like, I don't know, since I started, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, he burned me some CDs. Those were, you know, ended up being the first jazz albums I ever listened to.
Sure.
And it was listening to the Barney Kessel Trio it could have been anyone really, but something about just hearing swing and just nice chord changes. And I was like, this stuff is just gorgeous. Yeah. And I want to go down this road.
Totally. Yeah. That bug is really like every person I've interviewed has a version of that story where you're like, oh, this is way cooler than everything else. It's an amazing thing. What was your teacher's name?
He goes by Buzz. I haven't come across him okay, in a number great. Of years. I think his given name is Charles Tuning. I might have that wrong, okay. But everyone just All calls right. him Buzz. I think he's actually mostly a blues guy.
Cool.
He exposed me to jazz. I think his background was, I think he did the Berklee and NEC thing.
Got it.
And last time I saw him was probably 10 to 15 years ago, where at a blues jam session that he hosted at a bar called the Hey Hey.
Oh, yeah.
In German Village. Uh-huh. I don't know if that's still happening, because, again, the last time I went there was many, many years ago. But, yeah, that's who I study
cool.
with.
Nice.
And then before that, I studied classical guitar with Lee Mamlin.
Okay.
No idea where she is now, but...
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so speaking of the Hey Hey, what are some other... You're from Columbus, you've been here a long time. What are some of your favorite venues in town? Playing, listening, otherwise, whatever.
Dick's Den is an obvious answer. I remember when I first became old enough to go there. Back then, Ron Yednock was still doing the booking there, and there was a rule that, like, you pretty much had to go there in person.
Mm-hmm.
Some people could, maybe call the phone or something, but for the most part, you had to be there in person on Monday nights. And so Monday nights at Dick's Den was just like the who's who of the Columbus jazz scene.
Mm-hmm.
And so within 6 months of me just being old enough to even walk in that place, like I felt like I had already met and gotten to know or even made friends with
right.
like pretty much everyone who was playing jazz in this town, just because of that. But another venue that I would say is, very dear to my heart, this is a venue that's no longer around, but that would be the Columbus Music Hall, run by
Becky
Ogden.
Yeah. Some jazz arts group history in there as well, yeah.
That place was really special just for the fact that it truly was a listening room.
Yeah.
It was a spot, it was run by a musician, it was made for people wanting to be in that environment. And so as a young jazz student, it was a lifesaver, especially considering like I was aware that most stuff was happening at Dick's Den, but of course I wasn't old enough to go there. So thanks to Becky Ogden and the music hall, I was able to hear, a lot of the who's who of Columbus before I could, go hear them at Dick's Den.
Totally. Yeah. The music hall was a big one for me as well. What about like when we were first playing, we used to play at Old Fields and Scarlet and Gray. I don't know why, but I like going down memory lane for those places.
Yeah, I forgot about those until you just said that. Scarlet and Gray, that's funny. I feel like I feel like at Scarlet and Gray, like, I think I've only ever played there with that jam band that we were in together.
Yeah, Raw Doe, for all of you listening at home. That was a great band.
Or no, I'm getting Old Fields confused with Ruby Tuesday, because there was a jam session there way back when.
That was my first, like, jazz in the scene experience, was at Ruby Tuesday, yeah.
And that was also, that was cool because it was like, it was very much a cross-genre jam session. Like, if you went in there and tried to call tunes, it was like, yeah, this isn't the right place for that. And it's so, that was cool because at that time, I think calling tunes was pretty much what I was interested in. And it really forced me to, you know, expand my horizons of like, okay, well, who's on stage? What can we, you know, what do we have in common? What are we going to do? We've got this much time to put it together. Let's make it happen.
Totally. That's really interesting. That feels like an infrastructure building moment for sort of where you are now. So Turtle Boat is the reason for the season. We're going to be performing on the 4th of April at Longstreet Studios. Turtle Boat is your band. I happen to be in it, which is awesome. You know, we've been playing this kind of music for a long time, but tell me a little bit about, like, sort of what Turtle Boat is, and sort of like how the pieces musically fit together, and if you can see any, like, influence from your past. Wow. That's a lot of questions, sorry. Say whatever you want.
Well, so, I mean, Turtle Boat, and it's like, in essence, it's just, I like to think of it as, it's just my thing. So in a way, you could say, like, Turtle Boat's kind of whatever I feel like it is on this day or on this moment. You know, Turtle Boat's taken a couple different forms in the past. There's been a quintet and sextet version that plays, you know, more traditional swinging type stuff, which was certainly modeled after, like, Paul Motion's Electric Bebop band. But what we're doing and what I think the real focus of Turtle Boat is nowadays is... it's the trio. That's, you know, myself, you, and Dan DePiro. And I guess a little backstory on Turtle Boat. Like, after I graduated from Capitol, I spent a couple years here doing, you know, the playing and teaching thing. And then I eventually ended up in the Army Band. And when I say the Army Band, I don't mean like the DC bands that are full of, you know, great players and stuff. I mean like the regular Army Band, which is kind of like the kind of maybe the worst mistake I've made in my life.
Sure.
But I say that just to put it in context of the fact that in 2014, that's what my job was playing with a bunch of people that. The phrase, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all, comes to mind.
Mixed skill levels, perhaps.
Yes. And, of course, the musical selections were very uninteresting. You know, I was playing in, like, a rock cover band, and, you know, they thought percussion wasn't a real instrument, so they had me play percussion in the concert band. It was just musically upsetting and miserable for me.
These are, like, functional bands, right? They, like, you play functions and you do a thing for a reason. Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
A lot of community outreach to show people, hey, soldiers aren't terrible people. Yeah, look, we play music, too.
Sure.
But, you know, musically uninteresting with, you know, very ungifted, uncaring about wanting to improve musicians. And also that in 2014 in particular, I was at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, you know, in the smack dab in the middle of nowhere. It's just an army town. If you're not an army, like, you know, if that's not your whole life, like, there's nothing for you. There's no art scene. There's no music scene. Yeah. There was nothing there. I was just isolated. In short, it was a very terrible year of my life. And during that time, though... you know, I spent a lot of time just alone in my room after work with nothing else to do. So, like, I practiced and I listened to music, and so I, you know, I did what I could. But, like, this general overall feeling of hopelessness and despair was just a constant in my life at that time. And that led to something that I've lately kind of put a word to, which is, like, this idea of, like, musical echolalia. Yeah, it's, like, this a short phrase that'll just... it'll just stay in my head, and it just has to come out somehow. I can't control it.
Yeah.
And at that time, there was, pretty much every time I picked up the guitar, there was this one idea that I would just play. Like, I don't know where it came from. It just it was just there, and it just had to come out. I think, you know, probably just because of what I was going through. And that musical idea, it was basically just two chords. And fast forward a little bit of time to when, like, I found out I was going to be getting out of the Army. I was going to be coming home here to Columbus, Ohio. Around that same time, our friend Aaron Quinn was putting on a concert at Brothers Drake, with the point of it being to feature new composers and new music. And I knew that something that I wanted to do was take this idea that had just been, like, burning through my brain for the last year, and it's like, well, let's do something with it. And what did I want to do? I was like, well, I don't really have much to this besides these two chords that just repeat, because, you know, I feel like these two chords, they kind of illustrate these not so great feelings I was feeling during that time. And I didn't have any other material besides that. And I was like, well, you know who I know who would be able to just take this and make something absolutely gorgeous with it? That was you.
Hey.
And so I wrote up some very basic material, you know, for you to play, basically just on top of this repetitive motive that I had. And we had that premiere performance in February of 2015. And the piece felt great. And, like, what you did with it was, like, it couldn't have been what I expected because I couldn't have any expectations. But it was just... it just felt right, and I was like, this is a direction that I want to go. And I think that summer, we played Comfest, me, you, and Dan, and I think we did a version of that piece, and we did some other things too.
Yes.
But it was that gig that, for me, that's how Turtle Boat was born. The idea of I can, you know, with the right people, I can take some pretty limited ideas, and it can really... you know, we can kind of make something out of not much.
Yeah, so I was hoping you would get there. When you're talking about that, you're talking about, like, the written material is, like, pretty sparse, and then where we go musically is, like, wherever. So is there a way to describe to somebody who doesn't do that regularly or even doesn't know... let's just assume that there's no context for this. Like, what does that mean?
The way I think about it is just being in tune with yourself and being in tune with the moment. And so that could be, you know, what is the moment? That's where you are. That's who you're with. That's what you're doing. That could even be what you had for breakfast. What did you listen to? What was in your headphones on the way to the gig? You know, things like that. You know, when you're absent of, like, a formal structure that's written in ink on the page, like, it's not let's just be wild and crazy for the sake of being wild and crazy. It's no, like, there's still structure. There's still something that ties everything mm-hmm. together. And then in the context of Turtle Boat, you could say, like, yeah, that's, like, the theme or melody that we have. I mean, that's in all of free jazz, right? It could go anywhere, but you have an underlying theme or motive that ties everything together. But I think one thing that... I especially like about working with you and Dan is this sort of in-tuneness that we have with ourselves. You know, I certainly, one of my favorite things about playing with the two of you is I think in all of our musical pursuits, I think all three of us take a lot of influence from outside of jazz. Mm-hmm. And even though, like, the non-jazz music we listen to might be very different, I think all three of us, you know, even though all three of us are, you know, academically educated musicians, we can talk about, you know, aesthetics, form, structure. We can have that conversation. But with the stuff that matters to us and in our listening, we're also, like, we're able to eschew all of that and just focus on feelings. And that's, to me, that's a huge part of what this is, because... you know, so many people end up just having, like, a preconceived idea of what something should be based on genre or something else, whatever. And the cool thing about this is no one knows what's going to happen until it's happening. But I always have the confidence that it's going to be something that's A, gorgeous, and B, like, gets you where it matters.
Yeah.
Like, really, it comes from the heart, because I know that out of the three of us, not a single one of us is going to play something just because it's showy or cool or something. Yeah. We're only going to play stuff if we really, really, really hear it and feel it.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, yeah, I think that's perfect. And, like, to describe that special sauce, whatever that is, it's like the ingredients are 15 to 20 years of shared musical experience and playing together so much that you trust all these different things. But really, it is just like... you trust yourself, you trust the people around you. And my version of that answer is also like, I feel like I can go anywhere and I'll either be supported or wrangled in the most musically friendly, like beautiful way. Like I can go to outer space and eventually there'll be a landing pad. And I feel like everybody kind of feels that way. It's like the reins are there for each of us to take, for sure.
Absolutely. It's like safety. It's like almost a word totally. That I would bring up. Like, it feels improvisationally safe.
Yes.
You can do anything because we're going to support each other in whatever way is needed.
If you're going to describe, like, this, for the audience at home, this kind of music is pretty different than we've done on the Community Jazz series before. We've done some programming in the Jazz Academy that has touched on some of this language, but this is pretty different than what we usually present. So for somebody who's used to hearing Take the A-Train with a jazz quartet and everybody's taking turns, what's the big difference, just like top level musically, what's the big difference between those two things?
Well, with the example you gave of like Take the A-Train and everyone takes a solo, I don't think there's anything in our book where it's like, okay, I solo, now you solo, yeah. Now you solo. I mean, there's pieces where we all improvise or make a statement, but I guess the traditional, it's your turn, now it's your turn, that's not so much there. But I would, you know, to someone who's coming from, you know, very standard straight-ahead jazz and maybe has not heard other groups that play like this before... I would almost challenge you to listen for the similarities, because I think you're going to, in my opinion, I think there's going to be more of those than there are differences.
Totally. I agree. Yeah. When putting this band in context, let's talk about influences. So you mentioned Paul Motion. What are some other people, either inside or outside of jazz, that you really think about occupying a space in your turtle boat cabinet?
Well, for that, I feel like it's more important to talk about stuff that I listen to that has an emotional impact on me.
Yeah.
Because really, that's what this band is about. You know, it certainly had some of our origins were kind of drawn from some, you know, relatively specific things that I may have lifted from listening to like Paul Motion, for example. But overall, just given like. I mean, given the context of, you know, what we just said about, like, why I feel so mm-hmm. safe improvising with you guys, it's less about the notes, it's less about the texture, it's less about the actual sound that's coming out, and it's more about where it's coming from. And so for me, you know, just for an example, I wrote a little blurb about the record, you know, when I was pitching it to Amalgam. And, you know, in that I talked about some of my non-jazz influences because, you know, as jazz players, like we all know Paul Motion, we all know Ornette Coleman, we all know the Miles Davis Second Quintet. Like that's there. It's a given that those things are part of our mm-hmm. our listening and practicing history and whatnot. But if we're talking about just, you know, things that affect me emotionally, that's what these musical decisions are being based on. You know, there's in that write-up, I specifically mentioned like the indie rock band Thingy, the 20th century spiritual minimist composer Arvo Pärt, cut up harsh noise virtuoso Kazumoto Endo, and then the Japanese chiptune band YMCK, yeah. Which is maybe mentioning that band's kind of cheating because you can tell in their music it's very like electronic pop, but they're directly lifting stuff from Bach and Coltrane.
Yeah.
And but it's done in a pop context, and it just ends up being just really gorgeous. And I mentioned those four things because I guess that kind of gives you kind of sort of a broad spectrum of like where I'm going for
I guess that
for these influences. And it's, you know, I might not lift musical ideas directly from them, but there might be a feeling or something like, I don't know, YMCK does this thing where they just throw in these really tasteful, like, Bach quotes. And
sure.
I think there's at one point on the record, you could maybe have to take something like what I played out of context, but it's like you could, there's a, you know, maybe a couple measures where you could say that's, you know, that's kind of aesthetically similar to, like, you know, a Baroque counterpoint line that you might hear from. And, you know, maybe that's just in my ears from, you know,
yeah,
because of it having an impact on me in the past. And so when I'm improvising, stuff like that just comes out, whether it's conscious or not.
So this performance on the 4th is going to be a record release for us. It's really exciting. It's the first time we've made like a permanent piece of art like this together, like with this band. Do you want to say anything about that?
The first thing is it was a long time coming, right?
Yeah, for sure.
You know, the origins of this band being, you know, I say it all developed out of that musical idea that I had in 2014. The band's gone through kind of a lot since then, you know, like I mentioned that it had its more straight ahead sextet and quintet forms, but we've done trio gigs, you know, peppered throughout the years. I think the main thing that happened, I would say last year would be, I found a bunch of sketches of things that I had started writing but hadn't finished, and I finally found a way to finish some of them, and for the first time, I was, you know, we had a book that was full of originals, mm-hmm. without us having to lean on any other material, which, you know, I that stuff's perfectly valid too, because I think what makes us unique is, you know, our approach to how we improvise with each other specifically.
Totally.
So regardless of what the, you know, specific music is that we're playing, it's, you know, I think our aesthetic comes across either way. But that's certainly, you know, not really much of a reason to make a recording. But now there's, you know, we have the, you know, the recording, I wanted to document some of what we've done more recently combined with some of what we've done in the past. And I think what this recording represents is really 10 years of musical development and friendship between the three of us.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully said. So you can find the record on Amalgam Records. We'll have some physical copies available to buy, but you can find them at Amalgam. It's amalgam.com.
Check their Bandcamp.
Okay, cool. Yeah, Bandcamp's great. I'm really looking forward to it. I know Dan's looking forward to it. We'll see everybody on the 4th. Thank you so much, Abby, for being here. Looking forward to it.
Thanks.
Cheers.
The Jazz Scene is presented by Jazz Arts Group of Columbus, America's oldest nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the art of jazz. Our theme music is titled 3/4 Times by Michael Cox. This episode was produced and engineered by Carly Keim Law. Subscribe to The Jazz Scene wherever you get your podcasts.